Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today nearly live. We are in Las Vegas, Nevada, host city of the 2016 Continental Cup of Curling. It's the second time the event has been played in Las Vegas, previously in 2014. And it was so successful that Curling Canada decided to come back for this year's version. So we decided to come on down and do a follow-up to our previous episode from about a year ago, where we looked at curling in Canada and really look at curling internationally. Because one of the cool things about the Continental Cup is that it pits Team North America against Team World. So this year there were 12 teams in total, 4 from Canada, 2 from the United States, and they comprised Team North America. And then Team World was made up of 4 European teams and 2 Asian teams. So a total of 12 teams, 6 men's, 6 women's, competing in a variety of events. There's the traditional team curling, where you play 8 ends, high score wins. They have mixed doubles, which we'll talk about a little bit later, which will be an Olympic sport in 2018 in South Korea. And then there's the skins game, which is it's still 4 people, but it's different in that you only win the skin if, as the team with last rock, you score 2 points or if you steal. So if you have last rock and only score 1, it's a carryover and you don't win anything. So over 4 days, the 2 teams compete. First team to get to 30.5 points wins. It's out of 60. And it was actually a very exciting competition this year. Team North America was able to win. It came down to the final end in the last draw on Sunday night. So as I mentioned, one of the cool things about the Continental Cup is the strong international presence. And it's different from most of the curling events we see in Canada, whether it be Grand Slam events or Season of Champion events, which tend to be very heavily dominated by Canadian teams, obviously. But with only 4 of the 12 teams being Canadian, there's a chance to see some players who fans might not be familiar with, and for those players to get experience on playing on arena ice, playing with television, all these things, and it really improves the sport. But one of the things I think a lot of fans aren't really sure about or don't know a lot about is how teams from other countries get to represent those countries. So one of the things I've wanted to do this week is really talk to a lot of the players from Team World about how they get to represent their countries. So here is Eve Muirhead, the skip of Team Scotland, who won a bronze medal at the 2014 Olympics and is the 2013 Women's World Champion, talking about how her team has come to represent Scotland.
No country is a pool as deep as Canada, so right. We still have an eight team shootout to get to the Worlds, and which is never easy. It's always tough, but I think, as I say, no one is ever going to have the pool of Canada do. Mm-hmm.
And does this event, do you feel, help you with the national competitions for you going home?
Yeah, for sure. Like, yeah. We get so much experience out here. You play the best teams in the world, you have the best crowds in the world, you have the best ice conditions in the world, and all that just builds up to the best kind of prep you can possibly get. Right.
And finally, could you just talk about the logistics for you of coming over during the season and playing in North America, whether it be on the tour, this type of event, and some of the challenges associated with
like
that?
Yeah, like, for me, the biggest challenge is jet lag coming this way. Like, I seem to suffer quite badly coming this way, wide awake at 5, 6 in the morning, and some of the girls, they suffer worse going home, and it's just each individual person. But I think now we're pretty used to that. Like, we have a lot of help at home with our support staff through the Institute that help us with as much as they can to give us little inches here and there to help us get over that. And I guess we're just sick of seeing airports, ice rinks, and hotels. That's about it.
One of the cool things about representing Scotland for the Muirhead team is that you are representing the birthplace of curling. Of course, today, if curling is so associated with Canada, as you could hear Eve Muirhead talk about there, but the game was born in Scotland. So there is this added cachet to representing Scotland. I actually talked to Eve Muirhead's third, Anna Sloan, about that.
We won the World Juniors in 2011. It was Canada against Scotland in Scotland. And
right.
I don't think that's what you always hope for,
right.
To beat Canada in your home nation. But
right.
But again, it's not just Canada, it's not just Scotland. There's so many teams out there now that are it's just so close to call. But yeah, of course, I think just having Scotland in your back in general is just, you take a good prize.
The team's second, Vicky Adams, also weighed in on this.
Yeah, it's great. Like, obviously, it's like when the Canadians have the maple leaf on their back, it's great. And when we've got the thistle on our back, then we know that everybody at home is rooting for us. And like, where curling was invented in Scotland, so it's nice to be from the home nation and really, really show what Scotland are made of.
And one of the things a lot of European teams talk about is the challenge of finding good games in Europe. A lot of them have to travel to North America, and particularly Canada, to play against some of the top teams in the world. And one of the teams that actually doesn't have to do this nearly as frequently is the team of Alina Pats, which represents Switzerland and actually won the World Championships last year. They have the benefit of having a very strong curling community in Switzerland, particularly at the competitive level, as another world champion, Miriam Ott, is Swiss. And she talked about being able to stay in Switzerland.
We have lots of good teams, especially in Switzerland, in our own country. We have two other teams who are like really good and performing on tour, and we always play them in our own country, and it's always a challenge to win in our own country, to go international.
And what's that process like in Switzerland to be the national team, to make it to the World Championships? Is it a national championship?
Yes, there is a national championship coming up in February, and the winner is going to the Worlds in Switzerland.
Okay. Now, it is common for European countries to hold a national championship to determine who goes to the world, but it's not fair to compare those events to a Breyer or a Scotties because the talent pool isn't as deep in European countries as it is in Canada. A much better comparison would be the European Championships, which has a very high level of play. So when these teams go to their national championships, for the most part, they very much expect to win, as defending men's world champion Niklas Edin of Sweden explained.
For the Olympics, it's a selection. They look at all the international events throughout the past 4 years. For Europeans and Worlds, there's a qualification system that you have to win either the national championship or the Super League back home. We got two nationals, so to speak. Win either one or be highest on the ranking. So they can be a maximum of three teams in the squad, and then from that it's based on the order of merit, the world rankings.
Does playing in North America as much as you guys do, does that help with that process?
Yeah, for sure. And then having been out on the tour for so many more years than the other teams behind us helps a lot. So I didn't, before they changed to this kind of system, we won five or six qualifications in a row anyway, so for us, I don't think it matters, really. I think the teams behind us needs to take that big step first, and then we can discuss qualification systems. But right now, I think we're the team to play all the event, for now at least.
Now, that lack of depth that Niklas Edin is talking about there is common throughout Europe and also in Asia. The Asian teams that participate in world championships in the Olympics have an even tougher time than a lot of European teams in finding high-level games because they have to travel internationally so much. And this is something that Ayumi Agasawara, the skip of Team Japan, mentioned when she talked about the Japanese national championships.
Next month, we have nationals. We're champion. Mm-hmm. We call for you. Yes, we compete the world.
Are there a lot of teams competing in Japan?
The nationals were nine teams.
Nine?
Yes.
Okay.
But maybe three or four good teams.
Okay.
Only in Japan.
Now, with only three or four good teams in a country, it leads to the question of how popular curling really is internationally. When you watch World Championships or the Olympics, it does seem like other countries send the same team over and over again. Yes, they do have to go through qualification tournaments, but for the most part, the same teams come back. Whereas in Canada, the team that gets to go is often different because the competition is so high that it's just impossible for a team to win every event. So it does make Canadians wonder how popular curling is internationally. And the common refrain that curlers were telling me over the weekend was that it's growing. It's small, but it's growing around the world. And the Olympics are a big part of that. particularly when a country is hosting the Olympics, as China will be doing in 2022. And Chinese skip Zhang Zhilang mentioned that to me when I spoke with him through an interpreter.
现在来说还不是非常的普及，但是现在是逐渐的在一点一点增长，因为毕竟2022年还有北京。
We're actually growing because the 2022 Winter Olympics is going to be in Beijing. Yeah.
Because the Olympics are so central to a sport's growth, the World Curling Federation has really been pushing mixed doubles in recent years. A mixed doubles is a very different type of curling. There's only two players per team instead of four. And instead of throwing eight rocks, each team only throws five. The first player throws the first and the fifth, and the other player throws the middle three. And also different from normal curling is that there are rocks in play at the start of the end. The team that has the hammer has a stone at the back of the button, and the team without the hammer has a center guard. And this has been accepted into the Olympics for 2018, which means that a lot of the top players have started to look into mixed doubles, have started to play mixed doubles at national championships with eyes towards 2018, and another Olympic berth available. And this week at the Continental Cup, they tried some new rules, some of which have already been adopted to mixed doubles, one of which was a power play in which each team has the option at one point during the game, instead of having a center guard and a rock at the back of the button, to have a corner guard and a rock off to the side in the house on the tee line. Another rule change is that before, the team members had to be at opposite ends of the ice when the rock was thrown. That has changed. But they also tried some experimental stuff with the timing rules. Normally in curling, you have thinking time. So when you are discussing your shot, your clock is running. And that time is for the whole game. So early in a game, you can bank time if you feel you may need to have more time to discuss things at the end. This week, what they tried was to have the same amount of time for each shot, and that each sheet would have the same amount of time. So there were 20 seconds of thinking time during which music played, 20 seconds where you could throw the stone, and then 25 seconds of travel time. And all three sheets were going at the same pace. So as sheet A threw, sheet C was throwing, and so on and so forth. And it was a different version of mixed doubles, and it caught a lot of the players by surprise. And a lot of them weren't really sure how they liked it. And here's Mark Kennedy, the second for the 2010 Olympic champion Kevin Martin team, and currently the third for Kevin Cooey's team, talking about his experience with mixed doubles at the Continental Cup.
I think the idea behind it is good. You know, it gets the game moving and you got to be quick and it gets all the games synchronized and you get to do some music. And but it's a little, they just got to work through some of the kinks.
Right.
And that takes time.
Right. Was it distracting with the music at all?
I don't find the music distracting, actually. It's kind of nice. You know, you're so focused on what's going on that doesn't really get in the way of things. The distracting part is that you're always having to be time conscious. Whereas in a normal game, oh, you can use up some time here and there and gain it back at other times. It's not always on your mind. That's the biggest distraction. Yeah.
Now, one of the big challenges on top of the new timing rules for the world team was communication. This was particularly evident when a European player was paired with an Asian player, as there was a significant language divide between the players. And it was interesting to see how they tried to overcome that barrier. And Marissa Winkelhausen, the second for the Swiss team, talked about how she and her partner from the Chinese men's team tried to work together.
The other challenge was the language, because right. We are two different people with two different languages, so it's hard, but it was okay.
So how did you work together? Mostly hand signals or gesturing? Or is there enough
we can
curling terminology to...
a little bit from both. So we can both speak a little bit English. So, we can speak in English, or we try to speak in English. And then, yeah, sometimes we played and without tactic.
Right. And here's Oscar Eriksson, the third from Team Sweden, talking about some of the challenges that he had communicating with his partner from the Japanese women's team.
Try to be like straightforward, say what you think, like how's the line, good line, bad line, or heavy or light, so we understand each other as good as we can, because we have different ways of judging the weight and calling the line, so we just try to be as clear as possible, and I think we did it good, and Rachel and John made every shot, so it was, we had a few mistakes, I was a little bit heavy and wide on a few, and they scored four, and Sayaka played perfect.
Now, the Rachel and John that he is referring to there are Rachel Holman and John Morris, the team they were playing. And in that game, there was a bit of controversy. The last stone of the fifth end, the world team, in the judgment of the official, did not throw the stone in the allotted time, that she let go of it too late. So the stone didn't count. Now, this was controversial because she happened to make a terrific shot that would have scored 4 or 5 points. It was hard to tell from the other end of the ice, but at least 4 would have brought Team World back into the game. Instead, the stone was pulled. Team North America got a point and went up 9-1. And there was a really lengthy discussion about what was going on over on Sheet C. The other two games, because everything is going on at the same time, were delayed. So much so that TSN, which was broadcasting the event, took an additional commercial. They went to commercial after the end, as they normally do, came back. The discussion was still ongoing. TSN took another commercial. It was a really lengthy delay. Jennifer Jones and Brent Lang, on another sheet, had already talked earlier in the game about how having everyone on the same time was a major problem. There was a stone malfunction on another sheet, and the TSN microphones picked them up, being critical of the timing rules, because if there's a problem on one sheet, all the other sheets have to hold back. And this was particularly noticeable. The crowd, it was interesting, curling crowds tend to be very friendly and very positive. The crowd started to boo the decision and started to even boo the players and the officials as the discussion was ongoing. Team North America, John Morris in particular, threw his stones through, at least two of them, through in the next end, which allowed Team World to score 4, and the fans booed that. Jeff Stoughton, who was there, he's in charge of mixed doubles for Canada going to the Olympics. He was there. He was interviewed by TSN during the end, critical of that decision by John Morris to throw through, and the crowd, which could hear the TSN broadcast, most of them, through earpieces that were given away, cheered Jeff Stoughton when he said that Morris shouldn't be throwing through. And it really was a black mark on an otherwise pretty good event. And it really called into question the timing rules. The fans clearly didn't like them. One of the first questions that Jennifer Jones got at a fan interaction event was, what's the deal with the new rules? The new timing rules, the fans were confused by them. They didn't like them. The players didn't seem to like them. And this event, this dispute during this particular game really seemed to put that in focus. And here's Oscar Eriksson again talking about exactly what happened from his perspective.
It's a new system of play here with time clocks. You have 20 seconds to play rock. Mm-hmm. You can't play before that or after. And they didn't tell us before, like before the first game, they said it's up to the players. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of teams like being like more than five seconds late. Mm-hmm. And the umpire told us we were late, and apparently they did judging this game, but they never told us. Mm-hmm. So it happens. They're trying in here to make it good at the Olympics, so that's good.
So what was the discussion after the end?
Like, North America felt like we should get the points because all the teams did it last, like the first draw.
Right.
It was because it's not enough time to play. Like, it's really tough to make a good decision on the last rock. So many rocks in play, and I think it's better for TV if you can see some discussions within the team, and especially now we're one Swedish guy and one Japanese girl. Like, language is probably tougher for us than two Canadians. Right. So we need more time to discuss shots.
I also had the opportunity to ask John Morris about what happened. Now, during this interview, the head of media and communications for Curling Canada was standing there. It was the only time during the week that he was present while I was talking to any of the players. The Curling Canada seemed concerned that people know that the new timing rules were just experimental and that the World Curling Federation had asked them to do this to see if they would work. It seemed to me as though they wanted to deflect any blame from themselves for something that the fans didn't like or wasn't working. And I'm not sure why he was standing there during this particular interview. Curling Canada seemed very concerned in the aftermath of this controversy. So just to put that context onto this interview. So here's what John Morris had to say after the game.
What's happened is it's been a bit of an adjustment for us players because with the new rules, especially there's been some great additions, like the addition of the music in the background for mixed doubles event to help sort of, you know, spice it up also. And the addition of the power play has been great. There's been some really good additions this year. The timing one is one that's a little bit different for us and something that we're having to get used to. There was a lot of fouls yesterday that we made as North America that actually got because it was the first time it sort of got, you know, they let him go. And then, we're playing, we're having a great game, a mixed doubles game against those guys, and it was a lot of fun. And they made a great shot for four, and it was borderline if they had, you know, made it in before the the beeps, I guess. And so I just, you know, I've felt really poor taking a win to go up 9-1. You know, 9-1, essentially the game's over. I felt really poor about that because she just made such a great shot. So we decided to, we lobbied really hard to get them the 4 points because we didn't even know. You know, the officials made the call that she didn't get it off before it wasn't the officials' wrongdoing.
Right.
You know, let's make that clear. It wasn't the officials' wrongdoing. I think it's just, I think that's the one thing with these rules that I would really look hard at, another solution with is the timing we have, because it's tough to get into a rhythm. It's tough. I've heard from the fans. It's tough for the fans to sort of watch all three shots at the same time because they're all coming at the same time. And so I think that all the changes have been really positive, except for that one. I think might have to be looked at. I think that it's confusing for the players. It's created a little bit of, I guess, controversy and some challenging moments out there. And I think if you just get rid of that and you go to normal thinking time, which we've done, at all our other mixed doubles events this year, it's you've accomplished, making the changes and bringing some more spice in the sport of mixed doubles, but you're also just making it more, I guess, normal and providing a bit more, smoothness to the fluidity of the game occurring. So that's my 2 cents.
Now, that was the big controversy on the ice over the weekend. And there was also a bit of a controversy off the ice, and that had to do with the inclusion of the American teams, John Schuster's men's team and Erica Brown's women's team. Last year at the Continental Cup, the Americans were not invited. And it was the first time in the event's history that there were no American teams present. Instead of Team North America, it was Team Canada. Now, this year, the event being in Las Vegas, Curling Canada invited two American teams, and it really begs the question over whether or not Curling Canada wanted American teams there or if they felt compelled to have American teams because the event was in the United States. And part of this question is raised because the American teams don't do as well internationally as the Canadian teams do, and the event last year was a rout in favor of Team Canada and was a much bigger spread than you would normally see at a Continental Cup where American teams would be present. So there were some questions being asked about whether or not the American teams were simply there as token participants to represent the host nation, or if they had really earned the berth in the events. Regardless, the two American skips did talk about the lack of American participation last year. First, Erica Brown.
I mean, it's Curl Canada's event and they can make their choices. It's disappointing for us. I mean, quite frankly, it's disappointing because we've been a part of the Continental Cup for since its inception in 2012, and it's fun to be teammates, you know, but it is what it is. We're happy to be involved this year, especially because it's here in the U.S. and in Vegas, and so happy to be back with the team.
Do you think it hurts American curling that the American team wasn't included? Like, is there something for the teams that they really get out of it playing in the arenas, playing the top level competition that's here?
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity for the American teams that get to play, absolutely. And that's why we're happy we did get to play. It was one of our goals all season, was to be the U.S. team that was going to qualify for here, because I think there's a lot to learn, I think, from all these great teams. And also, it's fun. It's fun to play in this setting. We just don't get to do it very often. So to play in front of 5,000-6,000 people doesn't happen very often.
And here is men's skip John Schuster.
You know, Curling Canada owns rights to Continental Cup, so it's definitely their choice to do whatever they want with it. You know, we had a great thing in the U.S. to get a chance to go play in this event for the previous, you know, 10, 12 years. It's been a pretty good opportunity, so it's of course disheartening, but at the same time, you know, we're happy to be back here and hope that, you know, in the future, whether it be on Team North America or, you know, they decided to go Canada versus the world next year and we're, you know, ranked where we are right now, the third highest ranked men's team in the world, maybe they take us to play against them. Yeah.
Right. And just in general, where do you think the state of curling in America is? You know, ESPN has sort of gotten on board a little bit, picking up some of the TSN coverage.
Yeah.
Just from your perspective, how's the sport doing down here?
I think down here it's growing more than anywhere in the world. And we get great TV ratings when we're doing anything like curling in America. And I know ESPN3 is starting to catch a little bit of wind, like on the online era. And, you know, honestly, our Olympic ratings are gigantic. And we have new clubs being built all over the place. So that's... I think it's a sign that pretty good things are ahead of for U.S. curling.
Well, one of the things that the Continental Cup does, in addition to giving some exposure to the American teams, is that it lets curling fans watch North American teams against European and Asian teams. And one of the things that has been a refrain through curling for the past 40, 50 years is that international teams play a lot differently than North American teams. The style of play is quite different. But as more and more European teams in particular play in Canada with greater regularity on the Grand Slam circuit and the tour in general, there is a notion that perhaps the international game and the Canadian or North American game are starting to come together. And I was able to ask the two skips that represented Canada at the World Championships last year about this. So first is what Jennifer Jones had to say, then that's followed by Pat Simmons.
No, it's the same, and we play against all the international teams so often that you know them really well. So.
Yeah, they're playing, I mean, more and more they're playing a North American game. You know, there aren't really holes now in a lot of the strategies, and that was true of, you know, like Thomas, for instance, or Nick. They've been... you know, playing at all the slams and at such a high level for so long. I mean, you know, I don't mean them as much as some of the other countries. And, you know, but even a team like China that we played tonight, I mean, they call a good game and they execute it. And you can see that, obviously. And, you know, those teams, I'm always amazed how much they're improving time and time again when we play them. And, you know, so that's the onus is on us to take that next step as well and just make sure we're sharp.
Now, regardless of where teams are from, one thing has been universal in curling this season, and that is the adoption of directional sweeping. There's been a lot made of this in the press. This summer, some new brooms came out with directional fabric on the broom heads. Now, those have been banned for the season because there was a feeling that they were doing too much damage to the ice. But directional sweeping, or corner sweeping, if you will, is allowed. And what this means is that as the rock is coming down the ice, only one person is sweeping it. And it depends on which side of the stone they're standing on. And it depends on whether you want the stone to curl or not curl. It used to be that if you were sweeping, you wanted the stone to stay straighter and go further. But now some of the new studies have shown that if you sweep from one side, you can make the stone curl even more or curl even less. So for the most part, someone is sweeping the whole way down. The purpose of it is just different. And it's very difficult for fans to understand it because it's a different way of sweeping. And it also, frankly, looks a little strange when you watch the game for skips and throwers to be screaming at their players to sweep and only one person is sweeping. So it's a real change in the sport, and it's something that governing bodies, Curling Canada, World Curling Federation, and various national associations around the world are going to have to look at. And the players are really conscious of this. The players are involved in this process. So I asked some of them about the new rules in sweeping, and in particular the people who are sweeping themselves. Because at the Continental Cup, we had some of the best sweepers in the world participating. So in order, here's Mark Kennedy, Jill Officer, the second for Jennifer Jones' 2014 Olympic gold medalist team, Joanne Courtney, the second for Rachel Homan's national championship team, and Nolan Thiessen, the lead for Pat Simmons' national championship team.
It has changed the game as much as the free guard zone did. That's how much of an impact it's having on our sport. But it's also going to force the sport to evolve and develop some equipment standards, and you know, no different than golf had to go through when people started hitting the ball 450 yards. So the sport is trying to adjust to it, but as a player, it's certainly changed things. You got to be on the ball and do a lot of sweep testing, and it's changed things.
I know as a fan, it's kind of strange to see as the rock's coming down, only one guy sweeping.
It is.
Is that weird when
it
you're
is.
The guy not sweeping?
You know, to be honest with you, we're not a big fan of it either.
Right.
We like the traditional two guys sweeping, or girls sweeping their butts off. But you got to do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. The one thing we don't want to do is start officiating technique. You know, we don't want officials out there telling us how to sweep or, you know, what direction we can sweep. So, to be honest, I don't know what the answer is. We've got some quick fixes in there right now, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly paying attention to it, and, you know, we have some good resources that the girls are connected with, like Brent Lang and Mike McEwen. So we do a lot of talking with them, and, you know, we keep tabs on it and sometimes do our own things, too, and... you know, it's changing, and so we're trying to change with it and keep up with it, and it changes the communication a little bit, but I think we're finding our way.
Do you think it's good for the sport that the sweeping rules have changed and with the new equipment that it seems as though shots are being made with greater regularity? Or is that too simplistic?
Yeah, I'm not sure that they are yet. I mean, maybe in some cases, but I mean, you still got to be able to throw to the broom and with the right weight. I mean, obviously, if you're off a little bit, we can maybe manage it a little bit differently. But I'm not convinced that the stats are higher yet, or that the shots are easier. I certainly don't think I get in the hack and think that way. That's for sure. I still get in the hack and do my normal thought process. So. It'll be interesting to kind of see how this whole thing progresses over the next couple of years.
It's obviously a learned discipline. It's not an easy thing to pick up, and it requires a lot of really good communication. So it's something that the learning curve is quite steep. It's easy to miss a shot, you know, when you call it wrong. So, I mean, the game's evolving, and we have to evolve with it. So it's something that we'll have to learn and hopefully become the best in the world at doing that as well.
Yeah, you know, it seems to be an ever-evolving thing. I mean, we clearly see that with hits, hair is more effective than synthetic. And, you know, everything that happened in the fall was everyone's was kind of in the right place. We didn't want it to get too out of hand. And I think really this year there's sort of been an awakening of everybody figuring out the way you sweep and what it does to the rock, and then the different heads and different things that happen with the rock. So, I mean, a lot of it is trial and error. A lot of it is watching other teams that we respect and see what they do and try to emulate it a little bit too. Because if we're out there and we're playing a team and they make every hit and roll, then all of a sudden we're thinking, you know, they might be doing something right and we're doing something wrong. So that's kind of how we've approached it. And we've done some testing on our own and watched a lot of stuff, and seems to be an ever-evolving thing, but I think there's still the thing about it now is that right now it's just a moratorium. So I think there's going to be some extensive testing. There's going to be a lot of discussion amongst a lot of people, and I think that's good. that's good for the sport that anything that happens gets talked about and discussed, and anything that really affects the play on the ice. So I think there'll be even more changes next year probably, and it might seem like over the top and tightening up of rules, but to tell you the truth, it's probably long overdue.
And it's this last point that Nolan Thiessen makes there about things being long overdue, because there's no doubt that the sport is professionalizing. And as it professionalizes, these sorts of issues are going to come up with greater regularity. You know, the sport used to be all about going out, having fun, having some drinks after. And that's how most people understood the sport. And that's even how people viewed the top level players. But now with the Olympics being the focal point of curling, at the top level, it has changed. And things like the sweeping are coming under much more scrutiny, and more rules need to be put in place. Before, this notion of it was a game of honor and respect and these sorts of things, that's not to say that they have gone away, but in a much more competitive environment, it's a little more difficult to expect people to police themselves. Again, I don't think people would outright cheat and be blatant about it. I mean, people want to respect their opponent, but you can see it with every other professional sport. There's this notion of, well, if you're not cheating, you're not trying, right? With baseball, it's stealing signals. Same with football, basketball, hockey, flopping to get calls. These sorts of things that we've never had to really deal with in curling, and it's starting to creep in because there's so much on the line. People want to go to the Olympics. There's more money in place than there ever has been before. There are curlers who are full-time curlers, which never was the case before. You know, certain countries have dedicated programs to curling where the players are full-time. That's their full-time employment. Some Canadian curlers have gone to this. Chelsea Carey, in the lead-up to the Olympics, she quit her job to focus on curling full-time. So these sorts of issues come into play, and it does change the sport, and I think it changes the way people consume the sport, which is interesting because, as we talked about on the last episode we did on curling, it really is part of the Canadian social fabric, and people are exposed to it at a young age. People grow up with the sport. There's this folksy, homey aspect to curling that people really respond to. You know, if you've ever been to a curling club, there are strong communities that go around it that are very welcoming and open to people. There's certainly problems with curling in that it's not the most diverse sport and that it needs to get more diverse. It needs to better reflect what Canada looks like, because currently curling clubs don't do that as effectively as they should. But at the same time, there is this historic value to the sport that people can attach themselves to. And there's just something about it that is distinctly Canadian. And as it professionalizes, my fear is that that starts to go away. And even around the event this weekend, there was a sense among some of the people I was talking to who were not curlers that the players from Team World better embodied that than some of the players from Team North America, that they still had that attitude that we all associate with curlers as being very down to earth, being very open and being responsive to the crowd. That both teams and curlers on both sides were very interactive with the crowd. The fact that the crowd could hear what they were saying, at least those who were playing the TV game, certainly helped with that. But there was a divide between Team World and Team North America, and it seemed like Team World was just more embraced the entire experience a little bit more than did Team North America. And it seems as though in the past few years, Canadian teams are starting to move more and more towards this professional mentality that, to me, takes away a little about what the sport is and why people like it. You know, there's this notion of you're a lawyer, and then you just go and crawl on weeknights, and hey, you made it to the Briar. Like that, and that is going away more and more and more. And as it becomes professionalized and more competitive, part of what makes the game great goes away. And that's something that I am concerned about for the sport long term. The talent level is so concentrated now because of the professionalization that there's a much greater barrier to entry. And that's not to say that anybody could ever make it to the Briar, because there were a certain talent level, but there's this notion now that, you know, there are four teams or five teams in the country that could win the Briar. Before, it was much more open. And the same with the Scotties. The talent level is all centralizing at the top. Rather than, compete against another great skip, maybe two people would join together. It's very similar to what the Miami Heat did in basketball, is get the best players and bring them together. That seems to be happening in curling a lot. And it makes me wonder about the long-term viability of the sport as something that casual fans can attach themselves to, and that people can find connections to the players. Because the great thing about the sport has always been the players' accessibility. They wear microphones when they are on the ice, and people can feel attached to them. And going forward, I just wonder about whether that attachment will stay the same. Certainly this weekend, people had a great time. The players were accessible, but as a lot of them talked about, at that particular event, it's much more casual. There's more opportunity to be interactive with the fans. So at a Briar, at a Scotties, at an Olympic Trials, may not be the same type of attitude to the players. So it's something I think merits watching moving forward. But of course, there are still people who do have a great time. One of the best known of these is Thomas Ulsrud and his Norwegian team. They are best known for their pants. They wear the crazy colored pants and have the Norwegian pant dance, in which all four of them can put their pants on through dancing. Their pants start with the waist around the ankles, and they dance, and the pants go up. It's really quite remarkable. They did it before one of the draws, and it's quite impressive to see the way they contort themselves to get their pants on. But they are very well known for having a good time. And he really summed up the experience of curling and what curling can be, particularly in a city like Vegas.
It's that whole package, you know. It's you're playing in Vegas, you have tons of fun when you're not playing curling, and you have women's on the team, you know. You're being in world's women's, so... We have team dinners and have a lot of, it's great fun. So you interact a lot with the other teams, and usually when you play world championships or Europeans or even Olympics, you're mostly for yourself, the team. So it's good to mix it up. I see those guys quite a lot, So suddenly here we have Team Sweden, Team China, and some Swiss girls, Scottish girls. It's good. It's a really good environment, so I really enjoy it.
Is it more relaxed than
Yeah, it is. Way more relaxed. Yeah. But still, when you're out there, and you start the game, you definitely don't want to lose. So I was kind of... I felt that for a couple of ends there when I realized... Hey, we lost to Kevin Kuh, And I said, okay, relax now. Try to figure out the ice, look at all the, great atmosphere out here and everything. So it's all good.
I just love that last line of, we lost the game, but okay, fine. We'll go out, we'll figure it out. We'll have some fun. And to me, again, that's what curling is about. That's why historically it is relevant in this country and why people have attached themselves to it. We are a country where winter sports matter socially and culturally, and curling is certainly a big part of that. And it's because it's so approachable and the players are relatable, and someone like Thomas Ulsrud certainly is relatable. And I think that's really why it's popular. And again, as we move forward, I think it's something that merits watching, and how the sport has changed and how the sport reflects changes in Canada will be interesting to see, or whether Canadians' response to the sport starts to change, and that the dynamic, the relationship between the sport and its fans, how that reflects Canada moving forward, because certainly in the past there's been a deep connection that I believe was a window into the Canadian mentality, and historically that's why I believe the sport is worthy of study historically and is very historically relevant. And we'll see moving forward if anything changes along those lines. So my thanks to Curling Canada and all the players for their cooperation this week, to the Orleans Arena and their staff, which was unbelievable to me. The staff members there, the security folks, were really great. And everyone who I saw down there who wasn't a curler, who were in the stands, it was great to talk to everyone and to see everyone. Had a really good time. If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, it is historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.